Rabbi?
Hi, can you hear me now? Is it any better?
Yes, much better.
Yeah, much better.
It's much better. Okay, I'm using my phone, which is not great because I can't share the materials with you. It's going to be like last week. I really apologize.
It's much better, though.
But at least we can, at least we understand you, though.
It's very often people prefer not understanding me, but
my camera's we got on that just
okay. I'm really sorry. I got to call Optimum tomorrow. My wife's only been telling me for weeks, so you know, hasn't quite sunk in yet. But
now it's actually a lot better. Now it's pretty perfect.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm on my phone, so you'll have to bear with me, and I apologize. I will not be able to share materials, which I really wanted to. Okay, it'll be like last week. I'm so sorry. I'm having just trouble with my I don't know what it is. All right. But as long as you can hear me, I guess that's the main part. Let me know if there are any issues, okay?
No, we'll have to see all the people.
You have to start it.
I'm going to mute somehow. How do I do this?
Mute it yourself.
If I could just ask everyone to mute themselves, I don't know how to do it on my phone. If you can just mute yourselves, that would be helpful. I'll stop every so often to take any questions or comments. I think that'll be the best way to do this, okay? I apologize again. I really wanted to share some materials with you and pictures, but all right, we'll do the best that we can. All righty. So let me start again, okay? So in contrast to last week where we, even though we titled last week's class as London, we really moved around a lot because there were many places and figures that were relevant to last week's story. This week we're really going to focus for the most part on one city, on one community, which is Mashhad, okay? And we'll expand and expound on that. Also, in contrast to last week, and this is, you know, the reasons why I chose these four different topics, as we'll see last week, this week, and the following 2 weeks, which is I wanted not just to pick random episodes or random stories, experiences of Sephardic communities in the modern era, but ones which typify different experiences of Sephardic communities in the modern era in terms of facing challenges of modernity and of the modern era. So whereas last week we spoke about a narrative, an experience of community trying to gain acceptance, right? Trying to gain resettlement privileges in England, trying to gain acceptance within general society. Today we'll talk about a tragic, and again, like I said, I hate using these words together, but tragic but fascinating at the same time, episode of a community which clearly did not gain acceptance in modern society, and we'll talk about the reasons behind that. One of the things which I introduced the series last week was this misnomer of the word Sephardic, and it's probably no more correct than this week. The word Sephardic really relates to, well, Sfarad is really Spain, right? Is the Hebrew word which at least became the name for Spain, and you know, Sephardic though is used to describe essentially, we'll put it this way, although it sounds kind of condescending, but all non-Ashkenazic Jews, right? So whether or not they have any sort of origin or connection to Spain or not, we tend to describe them and to use the, again, misnomer Sephardic. It's very incorrect, if you can say such a thing, about today's community, because the Jews of Iran, of Persia, are an ancient community which came about way before Jews even thought about settling in Sfarad in Spain. And so they have really, for the most part, nothing to do with Sephardim per se, right, in its pure sense. But again, just because, and again, I'm kind of apologizing for using the common misnomer, but we'll run with it, and we'll include it will include that. But I think it's important just to know that. Okay, so let's begin. Okay, so again, the images and the map certainly would be helpful, but you'll have to bear with me because I can't do it here on my phone. Okay, we're talking about the city of Mashhad. So if you can kind of picture Iran in your minds, so the city of Mashhad is basically in northeastern Iran. Okay, it's in northeastern Iran. It's not too far, okay, and these are kind of relative terms, but it's not too far from the border with Afghanistan. Okay, these are also modern terms, but it's not too far from the border with Afghanistan, and that'll also become important. Okay, and what is the city of Mashhad? What's the significance of the city of Mashhad in general, which is incredibly important to our story? So the city of Mashhad is a holy city to Shiite Islam. Okay, Iran, as we know, historically has been a Shiite country, Shiite society. If I'm not mistaken, the Muslim world, for the most part, breaks down approximately 90% Sunni and 10% Shiite is what I've read or understand, okay? But the most powerful and most significant element of that Shiite society, even today, is Iran, right? Or historically, Persia. And Mashhad is considered to be a holy city to Shiites. And the reason for that is that in Mashhad is the tomb of the 8th Shiite Imam, okay? I don't want to go into the whole history of Islam and the break between Sunnis and Shiites. It's interesting, okay, but it's certainly not for now beyond the scope of this, okay? But just remember that Mashhad is holy because it is the burial place of the 8th Shiite Imam, who is considered to be a very holy individual, one of the 12 Shiite Imams. And he's buried there, and there is an enormous and beautiful, I have to say, based on the pictures I've seen, mosque, which is essentially kind of like a mausoleum, I guess, over his tomb, and that is what makes Mashhad a holy city. Now, because Mashhad, again, also a significant factor in our story, because Mashhad is a holy city to Shiites, therefore no Jews or nor any non-Muslims were allowed to live there for centuries, okay? Which I believe, if I'm not mistaken, is also the rule currently in Mecca and Medina, which are obviously holy cities to Islam, and no, if I'm not mistaken, no non-Muslims are allowed to reside there. And so the same is true of historically of Mashhad, because of its sanctity to Shiism, therefore non-Muslims, including Jews, were not allowed to live there. Until the beginning of the 19th century. Okay, so what happens at the beginning of the 19th century? So in 1826, a person by the name who became known as Nadir, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this exactly correctly, but Nadir Shah conquers Mashhad. He would become known as Nadir Shah. Okay, he's a very powerful individual. He was known as a very ruthless individual. And in 1826, he and his followers conquer Mashhad again in northeastern Iran. He would only become the Shah, the ruler of Iran, as a whole 10 years later. So he would only become ruler of Iran and the Shah in 1836, but in 1826 already, 10 years prior to that, he conquers Mashhad. We know a lot about Nadir Shah's military conquests and his governance. In terms of his religion, it's interesting. Some have claimed that he was... I could just ask that people mute themselves. That would just be helpful. I don't know how to do it here. Okay.
So just put everybody on mute.
Somebody's not muted. Can you just, yeah.
How did you put everybody on mute?
I don't know how to do it on.
Why don't
I don't
you
know how to do it on my phone.
Maybe everybody can put themselves on mute.
I don't know how to do it on my phone. That's
no, I'm saying other people should do it, put themselves on mute.
I know, I'm asking, but
there's somebody that's not on mute and is putting all this noise in.
No, I understand that. Hold on.
Okay. And I think this is a very, this is an interesting thing. Obviously, employers are interested. Are their employees actually working at home?
Wait. No, wait. Bear with me here. I'm just trying to work this on my phone. Sorry.
Employee monitoring laws in many jurisdictions, specifically Connecticut, actually has quite strict laws about
how. I don't know why.
Monitoring communications even at work. It's a two-party.
Hold on, everyone.
For instance, for certain audio and video.
Oh, here you go.
This is a little laxer, but in both jurisdictions, you should be giving your employees.
Okay, sorry, I got it. All right, sorry about that. All right, so Nadir Shah he's either Sunni or, as many have claimed, he didn't really, wasn't a particularly religious person. The significance of Mashhad is not so much to him, is not so much in its religious significance, but really because of its geographic and economic significance. Okay, so what happens to Mashhad is that once Nadir Shah conquers it, so again, he doesn't care too much that it is a Shiite holy city. But as we said before, and again, I apologize, I can't show you the map, but it's in northeastern Iran, and geographically, it's in a very strategic place because of the trade routes particularly. Okay, as we said, it's near the border with Afghanistan, near the border with Turkmenistan, and it's a very strategic place. Okay, so economically, Nadir Shah sees that it would be advantageous for him to develop Mashhad beyond its religious significance. So what he does, and you know, it's interesting that historically Jews have benefited from this very same mode of action by rulers throughout history and throughout the globe, is that very often, okay, when governors sought to increase the economic viability of their kingdom or of their area of governance, so they invited Jews particularly to come. And part of the reason for that is because Jews had a reputation, and there's a lot of truth to it, of being connected to other Jews, right? So Jews in Iran would be connected to Jews in other areas of the Middle East, maybe even into Russia, maybe even into parts of Europe, okay? And so Jews have this almost ingrained network of economic network. And so rulers, kings, governors saw this. And so in order to increase the economic viability of their own state, they would often invite Jews in to build up the economy and their infrastructure. Parenthetically, for instance, this is essentially one of the reasons, right? You can't kind of zero in on one reason, but one of the reasons why Jews were invited into Poland in the 14th century, if I'm not mistaken, it was for the very same reason, the ruler thinking that it would be beneficial to him economically and to his kingdom. Okay, so what happens in 1826 is that Nadir Shah invites Jews and all non-Muslims to settle in Mashhad again in order to build it up economically. We're going to fast forward for a moment to 1839, which is when the story that we're going to talk about really takes place. But just to give us a little bit of background that's not so well known, meaning we don't know much. Okay, so 1839, when the incident we're going to focus on takes place, we don't have much information on Jewish life and the community in Mashhad before 1839, before the tragic incident, which we're going to discuss, happens. There are different estimates as to the size of the community. I've seen 100 families. I've seen up to 700 families. Okay, so that's a pretty broad range. It's not huge either way, but it's a pretty broad range. Okay, so it's possibly that it numbered already a few thousand. We don't, again, know much information about the Jewish community there. But hold on. What we do know is that we do have records of emissaries. One important record that we do have is of emissaries coming from the land of Israel to collect money from the Jews of Mashat. Now, historically, until you know, until a certain point in the 19th century, the Jews of Israel, for the most part, were supported by Jews abroad. Okay, there was a whole system of emissaries. They were known as Shadarim, which is an abbreviation for Shluchei Derabanan, which means emissaries of the rabbis. And they went abroad. They went all over Europe. They went all over the Middle East. And they went to Iran also. And they collecting money for the Jews in Jerusalem and throughout the land of Israel. So what we do know is that we have records of these emissaries coming to Mashhad to collect money for the Jews in Israel, which does reflect something, right? It's not just a nice tidbit, but it does reflect that Mashhad was on the map, right? It was on the worldwide Jewish map. It was considered significant enough, and it was considered affluent enough, at least that they would be able to contribute somewhat to the support of the Jews in Israel. Okay, so again, we don't have much information. We know a little bit about some rabbis serving the community, but again, not so much before 1839. So what happens in 1839? Okay, so in 1839, there is some incident. And even about the incident itself, there are different theories, or there are different stories, I should say, bandied about the incident of 1839, which we'll talk about some of the different stories, right? The incident itself results in riots against the Jews and the murder of 32 Jews and the conversion of the community, okay? So there's some incident in 1839 that sparks riots against the Jews of Mashhad. Some call it, if you look in historical accounts of this, so some call it a blood libel. It's not your classical blood libel, if you can say that, right? It's not your classical blood libel in the European model of, you know, killing of a child, let's say, or to use as matzah for other ritual purposes, whatever the case may be. But there's some incident, like I said, which provokes riots against the Jews of Iran, of Mashhad. Give me one second. I just have to plug myself in here. Okay. Apologize. Okay. So again, so what are some of the stories that have been suggested as to what provoked these riots? Okay, and you'll see why it may be labeled a blood libel. Okay, so a lot of the stories, or a number of the stories, involve the killing of a dog. Okay, so one story is that a Mashhadi Jew, killed the dog in order to use its blood, not for ritual purposes, but actually for medicinal purposes. Okay, don't try that at home, but I guess it was common back then to use it for medicinal purposes. But so why would they get so upset about that? Why would the Shiites in Mashhad get so upset about that? Because supposedly, this Jew who killed the dog to use the blood called the dog before doing this, called the dog the name of Muhammad, of a different Islamic holy man. Okay? Alternatively, one other story that's bandied about is that there was a maid or a servant in one of the Jewish homes. Okay, so a Muslim maid, a Muslim servant in a Jewish home who wanted to get revenge against her employers. And she accused the Jews of killing a dog specifically on one of the Shiite Muslim holy days. In either case, again, it's interesting that the even the facts of the case themselves are somewhat unclear, okay? But there's some sort of blood libel, okay? Some sort of blood libel that provokes riots against the Jewish community of Mashhad. Now, we'll come to the results of the blood libel of the riots in a moment, but what we just mentioned in terms of the story, so the story, whatever the story may have been, the incident itself may have been, right, that was maybe like the spark, if you will. Okay, that was the spark which sparked the riots themselves. But we always have to consider, right, it's usually these things don't happen as a result of one isolated incident. There are usually much broader factors that relate to this and that contribute to these historical events. Okay, so some of the historical factors that we have to consider are as follows. One thing which we know already, which is that Mashhad was this Islamic holy city, and you could imagine who is attracted to live in a holy city. It's people who are, you know, kind of, you know, more extreme perhaps in their religious views, zealots, if you will, fanatics, if you will, right? Not to say that everyone is, but very often those are the people that are attracted to live in these types of places. And so Mashhad being the holy one of the holy cities of Shiite Islam, therefore it has attracted many Shiite zealots, if you will, if we can call them that, who were more than happy to take out their zealotry against the Jewish community, who, remember, they didn't even want them living there to begin with, necessarily, because for centuries, Jews were not allowed to live there in the holy city. Some, and this also shouldn't be surprising to us, some point to economic factors, to the economic success of the Jewish community. And as we said, Mashhad was important economically because of its geography, and so that, you know, created envy between the Jews and the Muslims in Mashhad. Another important factor is that at the time, again, Mashhad being close to the border and important strategically, a strategic place geographically, so there's fighting from outside forces. There's fighting from outside forces for control of Mashhad. So amongst those is the British, and it seems like the Iranians, who were trying to stave off the British, suffered a pretty major defeat at the time against the British. And so the Iranians, the locals, were looking for, again, this shouldn't surprise us, but a scapegoat to blame for their frustration and for their defeat. And so lo and behold, again, not shockingly, they found the Jews. Okay? Any questions until now, feel free to unmute yourselves to do so. If you have any questions or comments, if not, we'll go on to the actual, again, to the ramifications of the incident. Anyone? Okay, we're perfectly clear. Wow, okay, great. Okay. So again, what happens? So there's this incident, again, with taken together with all of these contributing factors at the end of March 25th, 26th, 27th. Again, the records are perhaps a little bit unclear, but around those dates, these riots break out in Mashhad. Tragically, 32 Jews are killed, and the Jewish community is given a choice to convert to Islam, to Shiite Islam, or to suffer death. Okay? And for the most part, the Jewish community as a whole outwardly converts to Islam. What we mean by outwardly converting to Islam is they make the Muslim, the Islamic declaration of faith, which essentially, I will not be able to say it in Arabic, but it's essential, or in Farsi, but it's essentially your declaration that Allah, right, God is God and Muhammad is his prophet. So they outwardly accept Shiite Islam as their faith, but inwardly and secretly, they try to the best of their ability to maintain their Jewish practices. Again, it's not a story that is new to us, okay? Well, we're most familiar with it from Spain, but we'll see, interestingly, some commonalities between the two stories, even though they really have nothing to do with each other historically, okay? So they outwardly accept that some Jews who are able to escape, okay, they run away. Remember the map? Well, you haven't seen it, but remember it in your minds, okay, where Mashhad is on the border. So some of them escape to Afghanistan, okay? And but most of them remain in Mashhad and they convert. So what's all of this outward conversion? What's it all about? So I would have liked to have shown you this, but I'll have to just do it outside. Is some have suggested, right, why didn't, right? So here's part of the question, historically / maybe religiously, why didn't the Jews of Mashhad suffer martyrdom, right? Why did they decide to outwardly accept Islam? Why was that okay from a Jewish religious point of view? So some have suggested that what the Mashhadi Jews were relying upon was an opinion of none other than the Rambam, than Maimonides. Okay, and where does all of that come from? So in the 12th century, so let's just give a very, very brief. The Rambam is born in Cordoba, Spain, okay? At age 13 approximately, 13, 14, his family is forced to run away, to flee Spain. They go first to Morocco. They're not there for very long for the very same reason they had to flee Spain, which we'll come back to in a moment. They travel through Eretz Yisrael, through Israel for about half a year or so, we think. And then the Rambam, as we know, settles in Egypt. Okay, so why does the Rambam's family, why do they have to flee Spain? So at that point in time in the 12th century, again, I don't have the years exactly in front of me, but again, fanatical Islamic group takes over Spain and begins to persecute non-Muslims, okay, amongst them the Jews. So the Rambam's father, Maimon, takes his family and he runs away to Morocco. The problem is that the very same Islamic group, the name is escaping me, I apologize, then take over Morocco and start persecuting the Jews of Morocco and of North Africa. Okay, and this persecution goes on for a while, okay? And later on, when the Rambam's family is no longer there, the Rambam is asked, a letter is sent from Morocco to the Rambam asking, well, what should we do? What should we do when this, when these Islamic fanatics are persecuting us and trying to convert us against our will? Are we permitted to outwardly accept Islam, or do we have to suffer martyrdom? And the Rambam, in a very surprising answer, okay, and this answer of his becomes known as Igeret Hashmad, which in Hebrew, which can be translated as the letter of persecution, right, because that's what it pertains to. The Rambam essentially answers them that you are permitted to outwardly accept Islam, to make this declaration of Islamic faith, if inwardly you're not really accepting it, right? Inwardly, you don't believe what you're saying. You're just paying lip service to the persecution, but you don't actually believe that. There's actually, and this is a matter of great, great controversy. You can look into it, matter of great, great controversy. But some have suggested that the Rambam himself outwardly converted to Islam at some point in his life. I once said this to somebody, and he said his immediate reaction was like, "Chas v'shalom, I can't believe that," right? But okay, historically there is such a theory out there that the Rambam did do that. But regardless about the Rambam's own biographical details, he does the Igeret Hashmad is clear that right, this was an opinion of the Rambam. So some have suggested that the Jews of Mashhad have decided as a community and their leaders, basically as a community, said that they will, instead of suffering martyrdom, they will outwardly accept Islam, but inwardly, secretly, they will try to maintain their Jewish practice as the best of their ability. Okay. Interestingly, right, so this happens in 1839. In 1843, 4 years later, the Shah actually allows the Jews to legally return to Judaism. Okay, so he basically annuls the decree of persecution and of conversion, and he allows the Jews of Mashhad legally to return to Judaism. That was a decree of the Shah. The problem was that Mashhad, because of its religious nature, so it was more bound by the religious authorities. The religious authorities were more powerful than even the Shah himself. They carried more weight in Mashhad. And so they did not allow the Jews to return to Judaism. So even though 4 years after the mass conversion to Shiism, the Jews are actually officially allowed to return to Judaism because of the religious nature and the religious power structure of Mashhad, the Jews do not return to outwardly expressing and practicing their Judaism. I mentioned before that we're going to see some similarities between kind of the quote-unquote classical story of crypto-Judaism, which we're probably most of us more familiar with, which is Spanish and Portuguese Jews in light of the Inquisition. And we'll see similarities between them and the crypto-Judaism, which develops in Mashhad. So one of the similarities, which I found actually fascinating, was not necessarily from the perspective of the Jews, but we'll see a number of similarities there, but actually from the perspective of the Muslims. And that was in terms of the name or the label which they give these Jewish converts. So if you know some of the history of the Spanish and Portuguese Jews or the Spanish Inquisition, so the name that they gave the Jews, so they gave them the name Marrano, right, which was a derogatory name. It means like swine or pig. The Jews, I think for the most part, called themselves Anusim, right, which was conversos. And that's how they were known throughout the Jewish world, as Anusim. Those were forced to convert. But actually what the Inquisition called these Jews in Spain and Portugal was new Christians. I don't know the Spanish of that, but they were called new Christians, okay? to differentiate them from old Christians, okay? And that was a religious distinction, and later on it actually became more of a racial distinction in at certain times. But in any case, that's what they were known as. And here in Mashhad, these crypto-Jews are actually known as Jadid al-Islam, which means what? New Muslims. Okay, so it's fascinating that in these two completely different areas, which had nothing to do with each other, okay, and not only did they have nothing to do with each other, one was trying to force the Jews into Christianity, one was trying to force the Jews into Islam, but they came up with the same label for these Jews in order to differentiate them, to distinguish them from the majority population, right? They wanted to maintain those barriers. And part of the maintenance of those barriers, what was so important to them in maintaining those barriers, was because of the suspicion. They constantly had these suspicions of the Jews. Were they sincere in their conversion or not? And again, here you see the same similarities. The Inquisition, if you know some of the history of it, the Inquisition was not really interested in Jews. Inquisition was barely interested in Jews. They were interested in new Christians. They were interested in making sure that those that confessed outwardly to be Christian were actually Christian. Okay, that's who they persecuted. They barely touched the Jews themselves. Okay, and the same thing, well, not the same thing because there were no Jews here, right? But the point being is that they had these very same suspicions They had these very same suspicions, and so therefore that distinction between new Muslims and quote-unquote old Muslims was very important to them. Okay, so what do the Jews do in order to hide their Judaism? One of the things that we know took place was a ceremony in one of the mosques in Mashhad. And in that ceremony, the Jews adopted Muslim name. I think I mentioned this last week that, again, I'm sorry to keep drawing these parallels, but I think it's actually important to understand historically, okay? When it came to the Spanish and Portuguese Jews that became conversos, right, that converted outwardly to Catholicism, many of them actually adopted very Christian-sounding names. Okay, so I think I mentioned this last week. Sometimes you'll see like a name in the history books. I don't know, I'm just throwing this out. Pablo Santo Cruz or something like that, right? So that's a pretty Catholic-sounding name. It's very possible that was a Jew, right? They often took upon themselves these very Christian-sounding names in order to hide their identity. So the Jews go into this mosque in Mashhad, and they, in a ceremony, adopt these Muslim names. And in fact, along the lines of maintaining that distinction between the new Muslims and the old Muslims, right, which was so important to the Shiites of Mashhad, they actually built a mosque for the it's called the Mosque of Jadid al-Islam, right, the Mosque of the New Muslims, where Shiite preachers would preach to the Jews about, to these new Muslims, about Islam. In Spain, the priests and the friars would come into the synagogues to preach to the Jews about Christianity. Okay, so that's in terms of the suspicions and really from the perspective of the Islamic authorities. Now, what about the Jews themselves? How did the Jews maintain their Judaism, right? Sounds pretty difficult when you're living under a fanatical religious regime that is trying to persecute you and to make sure, right, to ascertain whether or not you're actually sincere in your belief system. So let's just give a few examples of what they did. Okay, we know that they went to mosque. Okay, they participated in Muslim prayer services. They were very frum. They went five times a day. Okay, you can't kind of not be so observant in a place like Mashhad. And so they went along with the crowd. They went to the mosque. They performed. They participated in the Muslim prayers. They fasted during Ramadan. Right? So all of, at least outwardly, they did try to maintain the appearance of being devout Muslims. We do have records that they held minyanim in secret, though. Right? So they would, let's say, go to the mosque, and then they would come home, and they would daven, right, if you will. They would have minyanim in their cellars, in their homes, in places of hiding. And as the records show, they would often have a lookout, right? They would have a lookout on the outside to inform them whether or not the authorities were coming. That's in terms of prayer. Shechita, right? What did they do about maintaining the laws of kashrut and shechita? So this is, you might find this somewhat amusing, okay? How would they get kosher meat? So they would go to the market and they would buy non-kosher meat, right? They would buy meat that was slaughtered according to Islamic law. There may be some similarities, but it's certainly not halakhically kosher, okay? So they would buy meat in the market, and they would, what we're told, they would then feed it, come home and feed it to the dogs, feed it to animals, right? They wouldn't necessarily consume it themselves. But how would they, in fact, get kosher meat? So this is somewhat amusing. So we're told that they would specifically send a woman to the marketplace to buy the meat. Why a woman? So think about Islamic society, right? The woman is what? She's covered from head to toe, okay? Not only covered from head to toe, but very often, right, in very loose clothing. So if you're covered from head to toe in loose clothing, it kind of makes it easier to hide things under there. So what these women would do is that they would go to the marketplace and they would buy a chicken or something of that, right? I guess a cow is kind of hard to hide under your garments, but they would buy a chicken and they would hide it under their garments. They would bring it home, and there were people who were trained to shecht the animals, and they would shecht them, they would slaughter them according to Jewish law, and that's how they obtained the kosher meat, okay? So that's also another example of them circumventing the suspicions, if you will, of the Islamic authorities. What about marriage? So we have pictures, we have actual pictures, documents of marriage contracts, ketubot, right? A ketubah that everyone has at their halachic marriage. And we have records and the actual documents, a ksuba that was written, that ketubot that were written in Mashad. Now, what's really interesting is that very often we actually have two different copies. Okay, so we have one copy, which is a Jewish ketubah that you would find at a Jewish wedding. And then we also have, I guess it's not a ketubah, but some sort of Islamic marriage contract. Okay, so what they would do is they would have outwardly a ceremony to celebrate their marriage as if it were an Islamic marriage. And they would write up a whole marriage contract in Farsi, okay? And that was their, you know, official document, if you will. And then later on, or beforehand, or later on, at a different point in time, they would have a Jewish wedding, and they would have a Jewish ketubah. Now, again, I found all of this fascinating. Well, what happens if a Muslim man or woman, right, expresses interest in marrying a Jewish man or woman, right? So how do you kind of get around that? And how do you tell them, no, thank you, without revealing, you know, that you're not really Muslim? So what they would often do is that they would arrange marriages at very, very young ages, as they were infants. When the children were infants, they would arrange marriages between these two crypto-Jewish families. And so when later on, this Muslim man or woman or these families would come and express interest in marrying them or in arranging a marriage with this family, so they would say, no, sorry, they're taken already, right? Child's taken, I'm sorry, you'll have to, look elsewhere, if you will. The last point I wanted to just make in terms of how the Jews maintained their identity was in terms of what happened on Shabbat and Yom Tov, right? So it's kind of hard. The Muslim holy day is on Friday. So what do you do about business? What do you do about work on Shabbat and Yom Tov? So what they would do often is that they would, if the Jews were, let's say, shopkeepers, so they would open their shops on Shabbat, but they would actually try to the best of their ability to avoid doing business. And how would they do that? So either, right, the person would come in and ask for a particular item, so they would say, we're out of stock. So they would say either we're out of stock, or they would quote them some sort of exorbitant price so that they wouldn't want to do business with them. So they kept their shops open, again, to appear as if they're not keeping Shabbat, but to the best of their ability, they would try to discourage customers from shopping there, and they would, to the best of their ability, avoid doing any sort of business. Okay. So 1839 is when this crypto Judaism begins in Mashhad. If we go through the history of, we'll end in a couple of minutes, but if we go through the history of the community, so from 1839 and on, there are ups and downs, right? There are ups and downs in the history of the Jewish community of Mashhad. There are further blood libels later on. And then what happens in 1925? So in 1925, the Pahlavi dynasty rises to power in Iran, okay, take over as the Shah, and they rise to power in Iran. And with it, as we know from Iranian history, they bring westernization, secularization, and included in that is various freedoms that they allow the Jews to practice their Judaism freely. As we mentioned before, it wasn't always so helpful to the Jews. So even though the Shah himself may have allowed the Jews to practice their Judaism freely. Again, because of the nature of Mashhad being such a religiously zealous society and community, not all the Jews were still able to practice their religion openly. However, in the 1940s or so, so many Jews leave Mashhad. They move to Tehran and to other more open cities and more open societies. And beginning in the 1940s or so, although it's really just a trickle then, the Mashhadi Jews begin emigrating out of Iran. So we have the two major Mashhadi communities one is in Israel, there's the Mashhadi Jews, and one is in New York, in Great Neck, and the environs of Long Island. If you drive through Great Neck, you will see many signs of Persian Jewish culture. There are Mashhadi communities there. There are Mashhadi synagogues there. And there are, Mashhadi Jews in various places, including in our own Stanford. David Bassalelli's father, he can probably do a lot better job than I did tonight. His father was rabbi in Mashhad. So he can, and I have to thank him, actually, for giving me some of the materials, being very, very helpful. And so that's kind of the story. And if you experience the Mashhadi community, either in Israel or in Long Island or in elsewhere, this history of theirs is very central. It's very central. They commemorate it every year. It's known within their community as the Aladad. It's commemorated, it's remembered, and what I would say is that this history has really contributed to the formation and the culture of their communities. If you can imagine living as crypto Jews, essentially meant that you had to form very, very tight-knit communities, right? Very tight-knit communities. As far as I taught in a school actually in Great Neck for a year, and that was kind of my exposure. And from what I saw, what I experienced is that the Mashhadi communities, even to this day, thank God, they're able to practice freely. But that tight knit nature and deep traditionalism and deep devotion to their Judaism is something which they've maintained even though they've thank God been for decades already able to practice their religion freely. So again, the reason I wanted to raise this story and to talk about this story is really to show the contrast that whereas last week we spoke about an example of Jews, of Sephardic Jews trying to gain acceptance in the modern world, which is in a way how we often envision the Jewish experience in the modern world. And next week we'll certainly see kind of a more typical, quote-unquote, typical experience of Jews in the modern world played out in a Sephardic community, but not necessarily only germane to Sephardim. Tonight, we saw an example of, despite modernity, right, and despite the advances which the world, if you will, made in terms of acceptance of people and of others, right, quote unquote. Here you have a great example of people who were not accepted and who were persecuted despite it being the 19th century, where Jews, think about it, Jews in other places all around the world were slowly gaining more and more rights. And here you have a cloistered community and a cloistered city of Jews who are being denied rights and are being persecuted. Okay. Any comments or questions? Feel free to unmute yourselves if you would like. Okay. Well, if that's the case.
Rabbi?
Yes.
I know among the Jews of Spain, who the conversos, Judaism among a lot of them seemed to disappear.
Yeah.
But it sounds like that over the generations. But it sounds like that didn't really happen in Mashhad. Is that because it didn't last very long?
So good, great question, right? So yeah, when you come to the crypto Jews of Spain, So there's really quite a spectrum. There's really quite a range. You have Jews who really did try to the best of their ability to maintain their Judaism. And that's, let's say, on one extreme. And then on the other extreme, you had Jews who, you know, it's sad to say, who wholeheartedly really did embrace Catholicism. You really had a whole range. Doesn't seem to be the case here so much. There seems to be some evidence, some, although a very, very minor group of Jews who did embrace Islam, you know, wholeheartedly, we'll put it with that, but really just a trickle. The impression you get historically is that, yes, they, even over the generations, they were able to maintain their devotion to Judaism. And yeah, I mean, I think the time, we can talk about the nature of the persecution perhaps, but I think the time aspect that you're mentioning is very significant as well, that this didn't last for centuries, right? 1839 to 1925 or so, when they first began to be given their rights back, is less than 100 years. It's a long 100 years, right? But it's certainly, it doesn't match the timeline of the Spanish and Portuguese Jews. Anyone else?
May I say something, Rabbi?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. I just, since I lived there and I experienced it and I knew people's mentality and psychology, I just wanted to say what I think they survived.
Tell me everything that I said wrong. Go ahead.
Yeah, you did everything. You did a beautiful job, Rabbi.
Thank you.
The only thing is, I don't think in 1943 they would allow Jews to come back to the religion, because Qajar dynasty, which came before Pahlavi dynasty, there were four or five kings. They were pretty, pretty anti-Jewish. As a matter of fact, they made some laws 20, 30 years after Al-Adadi thing of Mashhad.
Yeah.
Very bad laws against the Jews. And Mashhad, the Jews felt they were lucky because they had accepted Islam. Those laws didn't apply to them because the Jews had to walk with a special clothing, with a special, they couldn't ride on their donkeys, with their food on each side, all outside. So Qajar dynasty, which came in 1943, 1944, and they lasted for about until 1925, and Pahlavi dynasty came. That's why when the freedom of Jews came, and the Jews, Mashhad, the Jews grabbed it right away. So for instance, if you go to the Jewish cemetery, the only time they started writing Hebrew on their gravestones was when the Pahlavi dynasty came. Before that, they were afraid to do it.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
David, how did they bury people beforehand? I mean, did they have a separate cemetery?
They had to do it in a hiding way. They had to do it in a quiet way. And there is the Muslim, a lot of Muslim customs are very similar to Jews. The Jews of Mashhad, they actually were happy that the Muslims did not completely accept them. This thing that you were saying, they were called Jadids. The Jadid al-Islam, new Muslims.
Yeah.
The Jews actually were very happy with that, because the fact that the Muslims were pushing them away is in a way what kept them isolated and kept them to themselves.
Enabled them to maintain their Jewishness.
Exactly, maintain their Jewishness. And then, by the way, the marriage at very young age was actually real marriages.
For instance, I read that, right. So sometimes, I read that. Some of the marriages took place at a young age, but the betrothals, if you will, were even younger, from what I understood.
Right. No, betrothal sometimes happened before a person was born. Sometimes cousins, they used to say before the woman gave birth, they said, if it's a girl, then it belonged to my son, which was 3 years old. So that's a different story. But there were, like, if you look, for instance, I knew some old ladies.
Yeah.
When I was a young kid, they were like in their 70s, 80s. They were saying they got married at age 6, 7, 8. They got married already at 7.
Wow.
So the only thing is, they used to get married because marriages was among the families, extended families. So the girl used to go to her in-law's house, and but they didn't used to live with each other, the husband and wife. The girl used to live with her in-laws, with the mother-in-law, father-in-law, with a whole big family. And then once he became of age, which is like 12, 13, then they started living together. But the marriage happened. And the other thing is that Muslim marriages that you were saying, it wasn't done by Jews. There were two marriages done, one by a Muslim cleric.
Right. It was an actual Islamic ceremony.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They had to go to Islamic ceremony to a mosque or where it was. They became married together. Right. And then a rabbi quietly married them either then or the next day or the next week or the week before or whatever they used to do the two ceremonies.
So can I clarify, most of the Jews then from Mashhad kind of escaped by going on to other cities? Is that how they did?
No. The Jews of Mashhad started leaving Mashhad. Basically, look, there was another blood libel in Mashhad. Rabbi Zwater started saying it. In 1946, I was a little kid, I remember that, okay? Mm-hmm. Then was the real blood libel. They were saying the Jews have taken the Muslim kids, killed them, and put them in their matzahs, okay? So at that time, mm-hmm. they killed a few Jews, not very few, two or three, but then the Jews had become already pretty open-minded. They already knew about Tehran, about other cities, about Israel, 1946, 2 years before Israel independence.
Right.
So the Jews were ready to run away from Mashhad already. Mm-hmm. So right after 1946 is when the Jews in big, big numbers started living Mashhad, so started living empty, basically.
And how big a community was it?
I would say, look, today there are maybe 20, 30,000 Jews of Mashhad. So it wasn't overnight, it became 20, 30,000.
Okay? Not in Mashhad.
I would say in the world. I'm sorry?
No, I'm just clarifying. Those thousands of Jews are around of Mashhadi origin around the world.
No, exactly. Not in Mashhad. In Mashhad, there is no Jew at all today.
Yeah. No. But how big was the community when it began to break apart in the 40s?
In the 40s, I would say there must have been at least 5,000-6,000 Jews at least.
Okay, because today, Stanford.
There are more like 30,000-40,000 Jews. They are in Israel, there are maybe 10,000-15,000. In Italy, there are 10,000. In Great Neck, there are maybe 10,000-12,000 maybe.
Yeah.
By the way, the Mashhadi Jews, with all the things that they went through, are the most observant of Persian Jews.
Yeah.
This is the only community.
That's interesting.
That's kind the only of, community that
ironically, but there's a lot of sense to it. Yeah.
The only community that maybe they don't do everything right. I mean, halakhically, they don't do something right, maybe the way they should do it. But for instance, I would say 95% of the people on Shabbat go to shul.
Maybe they're very, very devoted. Yeah, very devoted.
And very devoted community. But in Iran, in Mashhad too, the mosque, by the way, was not built for them. They themselves said, we want to build our own mosque. Because they wanted to be able to kind of control it the way they wanted to.
Do their own thing.
They usually send the women to the mosque and they themselves went to shul. When they had to go to the mosque. Because the Muslims didn't care, they wanted to see a crowd there. And then they used to hire the person that runs their mosque, which was a Muslim cleric. They used to find a guy that was favorable to the Jews that will accept a bribe and things like that. And he would close his eyes about what's going on and a lot of things like that.
Thank you, I appreciate it, David.
From the whole community, I would say maybe a handful became Muslims. There were some.
Right, that's what I said. It was a very, very small minority. Right. Yeah.
Some became Baha'is. Baha'is, which is a.
Oh, really? Also a modern Iranian. Yeah.
Exactly, a modern kind of thing, offshoot of Islam, that they were doing a lot of promotion of the religion among the Muslims as well.
Right.
But some Jews, a few families again, maybe two or three families, but that's it.
Right. Okay. Thank you, David. I appreciate it. Okay. Thank you, everyone. We'll continue next week.
Thank you very much.
So we don't have the same issues again. I apologize again.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Sure.
Thanks. Good night.